Yeah. We are going to be learning primarily this book, but our goal here is to go off on tangents. So our goal... No, so we have Thursday night and we have Sunday evening. But the tangents here are more focused. Our goal is to go off on tangents that will give us a better understanding of the background to the Talmud, to the Talmud, to the Mishnah, to the oral law in general. And when I mean tangents, I mean basically we'll take a quote that he quotes and we'll learn the whole Gemara instead of just reading the line. He quotes a lot of stories from the Gemara. So we'll read the whole story and then we'll try to understand it. And I also want to give you photocopies of the stories. I purposely read the Aramaic. I could have told you the whole story in 2 minutes. Instead it took 10 minutes. Because I think that one of the things we'll try to gain out of this class is to brush up on our Aramaic a little bit and to run through the Gemara. So we're not doing it as slowly as you do in Gemara class. But on the other hand, I think there is what to gain from it. Again, on this point as well, if you guys have comments, tell me. I don't mind doing it the other way. It's easier for me not to quote the text, just to tell you the story outside. But I think it's better if we make photocopies of the Gemara and we learn text inside. Give it 2 or 3 weeks and then give me feedback. In 2 or 3 weeks I'll ask you what you prefer. But let's first give it a shot. Rav Shrirai Gon. He lived on the Gregorian calendar 906-2006. So we're talking about approximately 100 years right 100 years before Rashi. Rav Shrirai Gon, he was a Gon in the yeshiva of Pum Bidisa. Now Pum Bidisa, there was a river called Bidisa, and Pum Bidisa was a yeshiva that was by an area called Pum Bidisa, which was probably near this river. Now this was a yeshiva that lasted, as we're going to see here, from the time of the Gemara, and possibly from the time of Ezra, from the time of the first exile, until it lasted longer than the greatest institution today. I think the longest institution is Oxford, right?
Oxford University.
Oxford University, I think, is around. Pum Bidisa was around over 1,000 years. Oxford has been around. Oxford is coming close, but they... I don't know how many years Oxford is around, but they still haven't made it to Pum Bidisa. Pum Bidisa was a yeshiva that was around for many, many years. Now, when we say a person is a gon, so we'll see better definition Rav Shrirai Gon will define. But what it means is that he attained such a high status of a rabbi that he was tested on the whole Talmud by heart. You know, the whole Talmud by heart, tested word for word. And obviously he knew the halachic rulings and he had a great tradition. Now Rav Shrirai Gon had a... Yeah?
Wasn't that also for the Rishonim?
The Rishonim knew the Gemara, but I don't know that they were tested. In order to get title gone, you needed to be... That was the beginning. That was the first stage of the test.
Was it like a pin test or something like that?
No, it wasn't a pin test. It was a verbatim test. Like, you have to say it verbatim, not with a pin. Now, he was from the descendants of Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel. He was... Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel was the one who led the Jewish people upon our return from the destruction of the first temple. After the first exile, when we came back to build the second temple, our leader was Zerubbabel, who was a direct descendant of King David. So Rav Shrirai Gon was a direct descendant of King David. Now, Rav Shrirai Gon was from a family who had headed the Jewish people in exile, and he writes that what happened was that when the Muslims came to power, approximately 800 to the Gregorian era, so they appointed who would be the leader of the Jewish people, what's called the Rosh Hagola, the head of the Jewish people, who he was given power to even kill. Sometimes he was given the power to judge and kill, to execute. And Rav Shrirai Gon says, when the Muslims came to power, so they gave it to the highest bidder. And there were Jews who were willing to bid a lot of money in order to be the top leader of the Jewish people. And he says at that point, his family said, we're no longer going to be the leaders, the official leaders from the government, as far as the government appoints. Instead, we'll lead the Jewish people from within the yeshiva. And that's when his family stopped being the Rashi Agola, the heads of the exile. They stopped having that official title of governor of the Jews, but they instead adopted the title of Rashi Yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva. So Rav Shrirai Gon himself was also Rashi Yeshiva. Now, he was a grandson of the famous Rav Yehuda Gon, and his son was the famous Rav Hai Gon. The end of the Gaonic period was the son of Rav Hai Gon. So we're talking about the very end of the Gaonic period. Now, he was well versed with the medicine of the time and the sciences of the time. When he was 81 years old, he compiled this letter. He was sent a letter from other great rabbis asking him basic questions about the oral tradition. And he compiled this letter answering them, which will give us a lot of basics in understanding our tradition. He was gone for 38 years, and there's recorded an interesting story when he was 100 years old. So, as often happened, there were a lot of Jews who didn't like him. So they said bad things about him to the Babylonian king. You should know this happened all the time. The Bris Karav in Russia, the Jews were upset at him, so they told the Tsar all kinds of bad things about him, and he spent a sizable amount of time in an insane asylum. That was the Tsar's way of punishing him. Even in the United States, there were Jews who didn't like Rav Soloveitchik, so they told the IRS about him. So they audited him, and the judge said, after reviewing his whole case, he said, "I never in my life saw such an honest person." After they tried to get him in trouble, they figured everyone has something they cheat on in taxes, not Rav Soloveitchik. They took him before the judge, they tore him apart back and forth, and everything was counted for. But historically, many rabbis have had to put up with congregants who didn't like them. This is a problem. This has been a problem throughout the ages. So Rav Shiri Hagaon as well. People said bad things about him and his son Rav Hai to the king of Babylon. And then we have a tradition that he was hung by his hand when he was 100 years old. And it is unclear if he died from that. They left him hanging by his hand, or he died a natural death. We know that it seems like he did die a natural death, because ultimately he was buried with his family. And usually a person that was killed, executed by the king, wasn't allowed to be buried with his family. So it does seem like he might have been punished by being hung by his hand, but he didn't die that way. But still, a 100-year-old man to be hung by his hand. Yeah.
Was it the exilarch who ordered his death?
It says the king of Babylon. I don't know.
So he wasn't the exilarch.
Exilarch? What's that?
That's the head of the Jewish
temple. For the Reish Galutza?
Yeah.
Ah, no. It was the king of Babylon. It wasn't exilarch. Thank you. You taught me the word.
Exilarch is from exile.
Okay. Very nice. Yishkach. So we know he lived to the ripe old age of 100 and his son took over. There's another interesting tradition that we have, that the Shabbos after his passing, so they changed the Torah reading. They had the regular Torah reading, and then they read the section in which Moshe asks God, appoint someone instead of me. And in the Haftarah, they also added the psukim about how they bless King Solomon, that he should take the throne in place of his father, King David, and he should do well. And they changed the words. And they said, Hai should sit on the throne, and it should be long-lasting. And that's what happened. His throne was long-lasting. 1,000 years later, we still have his works, which is what we're going to be studying here, of Shiri Hagaon's letter. Okay, so the Shiri Rai.
Shiri Rai.
Yeah.
Good question. Why is this that 1,000 years ago we had people that knew the Talmud by heart, and like now
we have people who know Talmud by heart.
We have?
Sure. I could tell you people.
The whole Talmud by heart?
The whole Talmud by heart. Still people who know the Talmud by heart. Rabbi Feinstein, this is Rabbi Feinstein who's around today, I merited to learn by. When he looks for a Gemara, so most people leave the top of the page. Rav David Feinstein. Most people leave at the top of the page. They look at the page. So Rav Moshe Feinstein's son, he leaves on the bottom of the page. He leaves like this, because he remembers the last two words of each page, like which page it is. So he leaves through it on the bottom until he finds the page he's looking for. And this is the way he's testing himself to make sure he still remembers. Yeah. So there's still people around today who.
Are there any Gaonim around today?
No one gets the title of Gaon. That ended with Rav Shiri Hagaon's son. Rav Hai Gaon was the last of the Gaonic period. As we learn it, we'll discuss why. When we get there, he will explain what a Gaon is and why they're given the title, etc. That we will get to here.
What are the modern day titles for that?
The modern day titles, so the Sephardim call their rabbi Chacham, the Ashkenazim call their rabbi Rabbi. Today, too many people got the name Rabbi, so they add Rav Hagaon, Rav Hagaon meaning the genius. And then a lot of people got that title, so they changed it to Maran, which once upon a time was reserved for the Shulchan Aruch. Maran means like our master. So only the Shulchan Aruch, up until a short time ago, only the Shulchan Aruch was known as Maran, like our master. He's the one that codified law for the Jewish people. So he was known as Maran. And then today, being that some people took title Rabbi and Rav Gaon, so today people are becoming Maran.
Title inflation.
So the Gemara, we will see. He will discuss title inflation. The Gemara discusses title inflation. We're going to see that he'll quote it. We'll deal with it then. Yeah.
What's the title? Admor.
Admor means Adonenu, Morenu, Verabenu, which is an acronym, which is what the Hasidim call their Rebbe. Okay. So Rav Shir Agon begins his letter with Arabic. Rav Shir Agon wrote in three languages: Hebrew, Aramaic, and Arabic. Depending on the language you asked him in, that would constitute the language he answered in. Meaning he'd answer each person the language he asked. So he begins by quoting their questions. He says, you asked, how was the Mishnah written? Was it... Now, we cannot take anything here for granted. He's quoting what they thought. He's not necessarily going to agree with either options that they suggest. They're going to say, was it like this or like that? And he might say it's the third way. So today we are just going to focus on their questions and maybe... we'll begin his answer. By the way, it's a relatively short letter. This is a book which has this translation, so each page is really half a page, and a lot of footnotes. So really, this could be in a small pamphlet. I hope to finish this letter within the next few months. It shouldn't take us all winter. But maybe we'll go off on a lot of tangents, so it will. That time will tell. But it's not a long letter. People sit down and read it in 2 hours.
You know if it's available in translation, English?
I'm not sure. I think it is. I think I saw a copy here in the English library. So, he says, the first question, you asked me, how was the Mishnah written? Was it the men of the great assembly who began writing it, and afterwards the wise men of each generation added sections until Rebbe came and sealed it? And if so, why is most of the Mishnah written without telling us who the author is? Most of the Mishnah does not identify whose opinion it is. Most of the Mishnah just states, this, 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 another law, here and there, the Mishnah says, and this is the opinion of so-and-so, this is the opinion of so-and-so. Why don't we have quotes whose opinion everything is? And specifically, the Talmud teaches us that the Mishnah, when the Mishnah quotes a law and doesn't identify whose opinion it is, we attribute that opinion to Rabbi Meir. So then why not quote it in his name? Why is most of the Mishnah without a name? Furthermore, we find that most of the names that are quoted in the Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yossi, were disciples of Rabbi Akiva. Now we know Rabbi Akiva saw the destruction of the temple. When did we start the Mishnah? The Mishnah, that's another question. When did we start compiling the Mishnah? So we'll deal with that also here. But the Tanaic period spanned at least 100 years before the destruction of the temple, and about another 150 years after the destruction of the temple. So Rabbi Akiva is the second half, really the latter half, of the Tanoic period. How come most of the opinions that are quoted in the Mishnah are the latest day Tanoim? Basically the last end of Tanoim. Primarily Rabbi Akiva's disciple. Also our sages taught us in the Talmud different rules. They said, when Rabbi Akiva, and this you guys should remember, because this will help you when you learn to know how the halacha ends up, when Rabbi Akiva argues against one person, he wins. He's got more power than one. When Rabbi Yossi argues on one person, he wins, meaning if there's a majority, if there are a few people arguing on them, they don't win. When Rebbe argues on one, he wins. So all three of these, Rebbe, Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Yossi, lived after the destruction. Rebbe is Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. He's the one, Rabbi Yehuda the prince, who compiled the Mishnah. So all three of these lived after the destruction of the Second Temple. Why is it that we allow the majority of halacha, the majority of the Mishnah, to be left for the later day generations? So that's question number one, or one and two. Furthermore, they ask, if we assume that nothing was written until Rabbi Yehuda Anasi came on the scene, how could we understand that? Nothing was written until him, and suddenly he's recording, and the only thing he bothers to record are the last generations that preceded him. Another question, let's assume that we understand the ordering of the Mishnah. We know that there are tractates in the Mishnah. Let's assume we understand the ordering. The ordering that that the tractates are in different, we have six sdarim. But what is the logic of the ordering of the tractates? Meaning I could understand that you have certain tractates that pertain to one topic, they're close to one another. You have the tractates that are laws of women, you have the tractates that are laws of damages, they're all together. But what about the ordering within them? Why so? Why is the tractate that discusses Yom Kippur before the tractate that discusses the silver coins? Why is the tractate about Sukkah before the tractate that generally describes the laws of Yom Tov? And why are all of these before the tractate of Rosh Hashanah? If we'd go in chronological order, the first tractate should be Rosh Hashanah. That's the beginning of the year. So what's the logic in the ordering? Why didn't they include other tractates that discuss the same topic in the same area? They had other questions about the Tosefta. They said, we know there's this Tosefta that Rabbi Chiya compiled. Was it compiled after the Mishnah or at the same time? Why did Rabbi Chiya compile the Tosefta? We know Tosefta are Tanai quotes that aren't in the Mishnah. But why do we need them? Why did he compile them? Not the Oraisa. Braisa is a general term. Bra in Aramaic means external, outside. Bra means a son. It's also external to you. Bra is external. Braisa are those Tanakh quotes that are external to the Mishnah. So it's a general term. Tosefta is more specific. We have many Braisos compiled by many people. Specifically, the Tosefta, I'll give you part of the answer. We know that Tosefta goes in the order of the Mishnayot and extends on the Mishnayot. Tosefta you have on each Masechet, on each tractate you have Tosefta. So they asked him, why was there a need to write it? Was it in order to add on things that will help us understand the Mishnah? If so, then why didn't Rebbe compile it? What's the need for an adjunct? Why do we need Tosefta? Even the words of the Tosefta are quotes from the wise men of the Mishnah, from the Tanaim. So why aren't they in the Mishnah? Braisa, what Zev asked, how were they ever written? How was the Talmud written? Very basic questions, right? And we're almost finished. What is the chronological order of the Savoraim? Those are the rabbis directly following the sealing of the Talmud. Those are the wise men following Ravina. Who were the Rosh Yeshivas who led the Jewish people from time the Gemara to today, they asked. And how many years did they rule from that time till now? So we have here a long list of questions. And now Rav Shri Argon is going to try to answer them. We have a few more minutes. He says as follows. He says, we have Rebbe, who's called Rabbeinu HaKadosh. Does anyone know why he was called Rabbeinu HaKadosh?
Our Rabbi.
Rabbeinu is our Rabbi. HaKadosh, the Holy One. When we use terms, and we'll end with this point, terms have specific weights. People sometimes think, if it says in Halacha, Yirei Shamayim, a person who's a God-fearing person will do X, I want to be a God-fearing person, so I'll do that. There are different levels. And a person could be a tzaddik, a person could be a chassid, a person could be a chacham, a person could be a rav, a person could be a talmid. People think, I learned by so-and-so, I'm his talmid, I'm his student. It doesn't work that way. I was honored today. I was by a procession setting up a matzeva, a stone for a rabbi, and his wife identified me. That's his talmid. So I saw people around me like looking down. Oh, they were all people his age, and I was younger. So I felt like he never called me talmid. I'm not sure she's right. In order to be a talmid, you have to attain a certain level. It's not enough that I learned by him X number of years. You have to be on a certain level to be his Talmud. I wish I'd be his Talmud. I'm not sure I agree with her. You have to be on a certain level to be a person's Talmud. Where all these terms in Gemara, in Halacha, in Judaism, when you know what you're talking about, they have certain weights. There's a Chacham and there's a Talmid Chacham. Two different things. Now, people don't know, so they use these terms freely. The term Kadosh, so ordinarily people say, oh, he's holy. Well, when we say holy, when someone who knows what he's talking about says holy, so it has specific meaning. The Gemara says, Why do we refer to Rebbe, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Yehuda the prince who compiled the Mishnah? Why is he called Rabbeinu HaKadosh, the Holy One? So the Gemara says that he never put his hand beneath his belt. He was always careful that his hand didn't go beneath his belt. So there are obvious questions about that. But that, when we learn the Gemara, we'll discuss.
What are you doing in the shower?
The bathroom is a more problematic one. But in general, we see that the Gemara addressed the question. The Gemara doesn't take these terms for granted. And the same thing is true when we read in Halacha, Yirei Shamayim, person who's God-fearing will do A, B, and Z. So people think, I want to be a Yirei Shamayim, I'll do this. Maybe a person has to first attain the level to be a Yirei Shamayim. When a person is on that level, then he's obligated to do this. The Gemara records a story that there was an Amora who hired workers to carry his barrels for him. So the workers were carrying, and something happened, the barrels fell and broke. They're towards the end of the day, they've been working all day, they agree on a price, and they broke the barrels. So he's upset at them. And they go to court. So the rabbi presents his case before the judge, and the workers present their case before the judge, and the judge rules with the workers. So the workers say, wait a second, we worked all day long. He has to pay us our wages. So he says, I have to pay them their wages? They broke my barrels. What do I have to pay wages for? I know they worked all day, but they broke my barrels at the end of the day. So the rabbi said, pay them their wages. So he looked at the rabbi. He was a big rabbi also. He is a rabbi in the Talmud. He said, is this the halacha? Meaning he obviously knew it wasn't the halacha, but he didn't want to be disrespectful. This is the judge. So the rabbi answered him. He said, in. Yeah, that's the halacha. Lifni mishuat adin. You have to do beyond what the halacha prescribes. Okay. So the question is, I'll be pious when I want to be pious. What are you telling me to be pious for? How could he rule in the court? You have to pay because you have to do beyond what the call of duty is. And the answer is that when a person is on a base level, so then he decides when he wants to take things beyond what he needs to. But when a person is on a higher level, like this rabbi was, then halachically he is obligated to go beyond the call of duty. He can't just say, the call of duty is I don't have to pay them their wages. So the rabbi who was ruling in the court told him it doesn't work that way. When you're on this level, you have to pay them their wages because at that level you have to do beyond the call of duty. So every person on his level has what he's responsible for. And when we say Rabbeinu HaKadosh, he compiled the Mishnah, so we have to know that means he was on the level, he was on such a high level that he's called a Kadosh. And we have to stop now for our week.